Good morning, everybody. It's Dave Weiner here, and it's Saturday, November 19th, 2005, and this has got to be a quick morning coffee notes. It's 8:48 a.m., and it's got to be quick because I've got to get out of here and get down to Palo Alto to be part of a panel discussion about the future of Silicon Valley at a symposium being put on by Harvard Business School. I'll be on this panel with, among other people, Mike Arrington, who is the editor of TechCrunch, and I should disclaim a friend of mine and also a lawyer, one of, actually, probably my primary lawyer these days. We did a big deal with VeriSign, and it worked out very well, and so that's good, and I appreciate everything that Mike's done with TechCrunch. But today he announced that he was going to be putting ads on TechCrunch, and he's going to be part of the FM, I think it's called FM Publishing Network, that's founded by John Battelle. And this is something that, you know, I've talked with Mike about a few times and have expressed strong opinions about, I think, would be an understatement. And today he announced that he's actually going to take the ads. And so, and now the conversation becomes a public one, and one that I'm sure he'll appreciate, that, you know, here's a chance to look at some issues in the light of two, I think, now dramatically different approaches to blogging. And in his post, I think he tries to minimize the impact of the advertising on his blog and on the way readers interpret his blog, although he doesn't mention anything about readers. And I believe it's heartfelt. I believe Mike is, you know, however, I don't think that he, you know, being primarily a lawyer, and having not had, I think, not having that much experience doing what he's doing right now, I think the TechCrunch is basically his first experience as a journalist, basically, or a columnist, maybe more accurate way of describing what he does, reviewer, critic, whatever. I mean, all those words would apply to what he does. That advertising does change the nature of the writing. It has to. It certainly changes the way the writing is interpreted by people who read it. But there will come a moment, I'm absolutely sure there will come a moment when Mike will feel the influence of his advertisers on his writing. He may or may not be able to write about something because somebody has been taking out ads. He may be more harsh on something because he wouldn't want the appearance of impropriety that somebody had bought an ad on his site that would therefore get them a positive editorial coverage. I've heard people say that they won't look at their certain things that their advertisers have done or invested in because they don't have any objectivity on that. What if FM Publishing or one of FM Publishing's investors requires an examination by Mike? Will he go there? And if so, will we get a fair treatment? Will we get exactly what we would have gotten had he not taken the advertising? And now I would argue that there's no way he can say that he would give us exactly the same because there's just, nobody has a good sense of perspective on that. You can't tell what the world would be like without the advertising. People might not say certain things to you because of the people who are advertising on your site. And I think that maybe even more important than that is the way people view the site, non-advertisers view the site. Mike started, as he points out quite accurately, it came from nowhere, and he's been doing this site for all of 5 months, and it's, I knew it when I saw it at first, that, and I told him so, that this thing's a rocket ship. You're on fire. I joke with him about him being at the center of the universe, but it's really only half a joke because he does seem to be wherever the action is these days. And I think that's cool. And I think that you should enjoy it while you've got it. And there's no reason to think that it's going to be short-lived. But, you know, everything in life basically is short-lived because we are short-lived. And that you should enjoy it while you've got it. But I would like Mike to serve as a role model because of his rapid rise to, you know, notoriety or importance or visibility or whatever. I would like him to serve as a role model to other people who might be looking at this and saying, you know, is that something that I could do? And the more elite you become, the more, you know, sort of barriers that you build between yourself and an ordinary person, the less you serve as the role model. And I have a pretty strong opinion about Mattel and the world that he is at the center of. And it's very elite. It's very sort of like we're up here and you're down there. And, you know, he's buddies with Google. You'll never hear Mattel say anything negative about Google. I mean, you know, he sometimes says that he's saying things about that are negative about Google, but if you read what he ends up writing, it ends up not being very negative. And you know, there's no reason to say that you have to be negative about Google. I try to be balanced about it. And there are some things that they do that are good. And when they do that, I try to say that that's what they, you know, have done. And there are some things that Google does that are bad, and some things that are very bad. And then you've got to say those things too. And I've never seen Mattel stand up and say, you know, Google has done something that's bad or very bad, and never taken a long-term principled stand based on that, which is one of the obligations I think that a journalist has. That, you know, but pretty much I want to know what you think. I don't want to know what Google wants you to think, or, you know, or in this case of in the case of Mattel, I don't expect him to tell me what he thinks, or I have no idea what he actually thinks, or for that matter, if he actually does think, because all I really ever hear from him are things that really suit his advertiser. And if you don't think Google is his advertiser, we'll look to see the book that he wrote, and you know, and where, you know, whose cooperation did he require to get that book to happen. And really, could he have said anything very negative about Google? And I don't think he could. Those guys at Google have very thin skins. And anybody, therefore, by the way, this is a hidden liability of their, you know, their attack on news.com. And by the way, they shut out bloggers, and nobody even considers that controversial. I mean, because I've criticized them, I never get briefed, never get offered any advance notice of anything that they're doing. They honestly never relate to me on any basis other than shunning me, which is exactly what they did with news.com. And it's their MO, it's their modus operandi. If they don't like what you say, you're out, which is not a very good way to manage public relations. And dealing with bloggers is, if anything, it is public relations. So, you know, if you see a guy who's number one on Google's list in terms of getting advanced information, which is Patel, well, one has to figure that Patel is never, ever, ever, ever saying anything that they don't want him to say. I mean, it is not a sure thing, okay? I will, you know, being a scientist and a person who is just like, I insist on knowing whether I'm speculating or whether I'm stating fact, and I am speculating here. But it's one of those, it's like the theory of evolution is speculation. Well, I suppose. But we see so much evidence of it that, you know, it's pretty much a law at this point. Well, I hate to see a guy like Arrington, who I know says what he thinks, okay? I know because I don't hear a delta. I don't hear a difference between what Mike says privately and what Mike says publicly. Right? And I'm a friend of his, and so I can therefore vouch for Mike's integrity. I know that what you're getting on TechCrunch is what Mike actually thinks. Unless, you know, again, I got to hedge that, unless he's very good at masking what he thinks. But I've seen Mike in some pretty outrageous situations, kind of have a sense of how the guy's mind works. I'm learning more and more about it all the time, basically. But I think that once one's taking advertising and getting that association with what I think is a very questionable whether what Patel does is journalism or not is, to me, not really in question. Journalism is the furthest thing from what Patel does. He's a moneymaker. He's a money machine. And, you know, let's be clear about that. And so that when you tie into a network that's built around making money, I don't doubt that you're going to make money. However, I don't think I'm going to feel as comfortable pointing. I mean, I don't think I won't feel as comfortable pointing to Arrington's stuff as I did in the past. It just is. I just know that he's going to be under pressure. And I don't like it. I guess I said that in a comment on his blog, and I want to say that in a podcast, because I don't think that, you know, I think intonation is an important thing about this. I still consider Mike a friend. I absolutely do. No, and that's a term I do not use lightly. I mean, I don't call people friends very easily. He's been there for me when I've needed help, amply. You know, no question his loyalty. I don't question his loyalty. I don't take this personally. But on the other hand, there's a separation in my world. There's a separation between my friendships, which I try to disclaim so that you know who I'm not likely to criticize, or where criticism comes a little bit more difficulty than with others. But my credibility is established by the fact that I say what I think, and whether you're a friend of mine or not, it doesn't matter. And if you can't be a friend of mine and accept the fact that I say what I think, then we're not going to be friends. That's what's going to give. I don't consider it friendship if, in order to be a friend of somebody's, that I have to withhold what I think. That's not friendship. That's entanglement. That's slavery in a way. It's certainly intellectual slavery. I would never, ever, ever want Mike to feel that he couldn't say things publicly just because I wouldn't like it if he said it. And I hope that that's never happened. And I hope it doesn't happen either. So that's part one of today's podcast. And yeah, I do keep track of these things. So we're about 12 minutes into it right now. The other side, and it just turned 9 o'clock. You can hear the bells in the background. Okay. Maybe you can. I hope you can. Anyway, switching gears quickly. Today I proposed in a post on www.opml.org that first of all, I want to say this pretty clearly, if it isn't totally obvious, that I will be doing a new OPML spec. And there's just been so much activity around OPML and so much forward motion, which I think is wonderful, and that that people have been willing to discuss this stuff, even though there have been a few sort of negative comments here and there. It has not erupted in a flame war, which is, I think, you know, it's good. It's unfortunate that flame wars have in the past kept OPML from evolving. I think that now it's very clear that we're beyond that. And so that's good. And I will be writing a new spec. And the important thing to say, my philosophy, I mentioned this obliquely, I think it was yesterday or the day before, that I have a rule one in the work that I do, and that's rule one is no breakage, meaning that as you move forward, you maintain compatibility with what existed in the past. And despite what you've heard from other people, RSS 2.0 is forward compatible with, in other words, meaning that it's forward compatible with RSS 092 and RSS 091, which means basically that an 091 file, if you were to just change the version number, would be a 2.0 file, and same thing's true of a 0.92 file. The same people like to say that there's such a thing as 093 and 094. It's really frustrating that they do that, because if you read it's very clear from reading the documents that even mention those numbers that they were for discussion purposes only. They never got turned into versions of the format. And those are people with an axe to grind. They don't disclose their conflicts of interest, and And one of them is O'Reilly Associates, because their document is still number one hit for RSS on the web, and it quite inaccurately says that there are all these different versions of RSS, which I don't think they would like it if somebody did that about their work, said, you know, posted all that misinformation so publicly about things that they cared about. But and they've more or less for a while controlled the conversation about this. No more. It doesn't seem to be true anymore. So that's good. And maybe they'll reconsider whether or not they really want to be a source for such inaccurate information about what's turned into a pretty popular format. Some even call it a juggernaut, which I think is actually a fair way of describing what RSS has become. So in any case, OPML is going to move, and it is moving. I want it to coalesce. I want it to become clearer what OPML is. I want people to criticize the spec. I want the spec to be better. I don't expect it to be make everybody happy in every regard, but I want it to be clearer for people and easier to deploy. And I also want to address some of the issues that have come up over the years. I mean, OPML is not a new format. It's existed since the year 2000. The world has changed, and certain applications have changed. It's used for different things than perhaps it was anticipated that it would be used for. So I want to address, and like anything that's been around as long as OPML has, we know where the enhancements and fixes are needed. You hear about them so often that after 5 years, there's really no guesswork about it. And one of the things that's been sort of standing out as a problem in OPML has been the owner email sub-element of the head element. And what that asks you to do, let me just actually get the spec up here so I can look. Owner email. It says owner email is a string, comma, the email address of the owner of the document. Well, putting an email address in an OPML document, which is then available on the public web, sort of is, you know, the spam writer's paradise. And although I don't think a tremendous amount of spam has resulted from this, it certainly makes people uncomfortable in 2005 to put their email address in a public document. All of my OPML files have my email address in it, and yep, I get a lot of spam, and I don't like it myself. But it isn't like something that I ask other people to do that I don't do myself, which I think is an important, you know, important consideration. But there is a way to approach this that allows for, I mean, say conservatively would result in less spam, make it harder, for somebody to spam you, as a result of having, you know, identified yourself as the author of an OPML document, and will be more futuristic in the sense that should that method end up becoming, you know, spam infested, that we won't require a modification to the OPML format or spec to be able to address that. So, what I've suggested for discussion purposes only, now this is not, I'm not, the document that I've written on opml.org and the contents of this podcast are not a spec. You're not allowed to say that I've invented a new version of OPML as a result of asking for discussion. I mean, you know, by inferring all that, it's really, I think the intention was clear, to put a complete chill on any discussion, on open discussion of the evolution of a format. Well, you know, it's sort of a catch-22. We want to do all the discussing in the open so that basically people don't feel like they're left out of the discussion, so that it's completely transparent. But however, if by discussing it, that implies to people, allows them to say, well, there's a new format, well, you know, well, it doesn't. And if somebody does that, I would ask people to politely and respectfully point out to them that it was specifically disclaimed. This is just for discussion purposes. Do not deploy this. Don't refer to this as a spec. This is just the beginning of a discussion. And so anyway, the idea is that we have a new element that's a sub-element of head, and it's called Owner ID, and the I is capitalized, so it's inner case, and it's spelled O-W-N-E-R, capital I, lowercase d, and it says, Owner ID is the address of a web page that contains an HTML form that allows a human reader to communicate with the author of the document via email or other means. It's a mouthful, isn't it? And basically, the idea is that, you know, we've come up with a way, and I didn't say I came up with it, it was come up with by the community in a variety of different contexts of giving people a way to send an email message to the author of a document without revealing that person's email address. And it's done with a web form. And the application that's running behind that form knows the email address, but it doesn't publish the email address. And so, and you can see in the example that I've posted here, if you actually go to the link, you'll see that there's a page that works exactly like that. And, you know, a bunch of comments came up and said, well, couldn't you spam that? And I said, yeah, you could spam that. And in fact, people probably have spammed stuff like that. But then you could also put any defense that you want to in the way of that. It's the same problem that Blogspot has, for example, when it comes to creating weblogs. It's a problem that is going to have to be dealt with in a variety of different contexts. And it sort of brings OPML into that solution space so that once it's solved, wherever, you know, you allow open commenting, that solution will apply equally well right here. What's also cool about this, and I mentioned this in the notes, is that, you know, and this, by the way, is not any, in any way is this a new idea. It's been discussed widely and openly in many different contexts that the URL of a web page is a much better way of identifying a person than an email address is. It gives us a lot more flexibility, and it's harder to spam, being two of the reasons. There are other reasons why it's a good thing. And what I suggest here is merely the solution as it applies to OPML. The same idea could be applied, the exact same idea could be applied to RSS 2.0 in the form of a namespace. And at some point, if nobody finds a deal stopper for this, I expect at some point that I will propose such a namespace for RSS 2.0. And but that in any other context, the idea of putting a URL in as the identifier of a user or an author, I think, well, there's been a lot of discussion about that recently amongst developers, not necessarily publicly, but it's an idea. I think many people would agree that it's an idea whose time has come. And so by proposing this as the solution for OPML, I hope to get maybe even a broader discussion going out in public. And then also wanted to point out that because what we're pointing to here is an HTML page, all right, that means that that all of the extension mechanisms of HTML come into play here, particularly the link element in HTML, which allows you to link in, for example, a FOAF, F-O-A-F file, which stands for friend of a friend. That's an RDF-based format, which has become quite popular, as a way of representing a network of friends and metadata about each of the individuals in that network. You could also use it to link to an RSS 2.0 feed, which would provide news from that person. It could also be related back to the OPML file using the RSS 2.0 category element so that each news item in that RSS feed could then be routed to a category within the OPML document that is being linked to through the link element in the HTML page. It ends up fitting together, plugging together pretty nicely, and gives us the kind of extensibility that people want in an identity solution, an identity system. So I was thinking about all this stuff while I was doing this too. That and there's been so much time to think about it. It, you know, it, there's literally been almost 5 years to think. So I'm kind of sure that this is good, but as always, it's important to give everybody a chance to say what they have to say about this, and then sort of in balance to decide if, okay, this isn't the solution for every context. Rather, it's simply the solution for one format, for OPML. And OPML absolutely needs to address this situation. As I said earlier, you know when a, you know, after a certain period of time, you know what needs to be addressed in a software product or in a file format. You know where the issues are. And this one can be addressed without violating Rule 1. There will be no breakage as a result of this. So all around, I think it's a pretty good deal. And I wanted to talk about this in a podcast because it's that important. So anyway, I guess that's about it for Morning Coffee Notes. This is November 19th, 2005. And look forward to seeing you all real soon. Okay, take care. Bye.